Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and I'm happy to say that the following interview is brought to you with permission by the excellent podcast, Who Makes Sense? A History of Capitalism. I hope that you enjoy this episode, and I hope that you visit Who Makes Sense.
Today is May Day, a holiday and celebration of workers all over the world. It's also the one-year anniversary of Who Makes Sense. For a year, we've been producing this show, bringing critical histories of capitalism to your ears, and we're excited to embark on our second year.
Today's show takes a look at the field of logistics, which our guest argues lies at the core of globalization, national and international security, and huge shifts in workers' economic and political power.
When we think of logistics, we might focus on the colloquial use of the term, the nuts and bolts work of getting things done, like making a step-by-step plan or figuring out how best to get from one place to another. And in fact, that's exactly the kind of work we're talking about, though on a much larger scale.
How did the humdrum business of planning a supply chain come to be so important to global capitalism? And why should we care about this kind of work, which most people find excruciatingly boring?
Today, we speak with Deb Cowan about what she has dubbed the deadly life of logistics.
You are listening to Who Makes Sense, a History of Capitalism podcast.
Betsy Beasley.
And I'm David Stein.
Who Makes Sense is a monthly podcast devoted to bringing you engaging stories that explain how capitalism has changed over time.
We interview historians and social and cultural critics about capitalism's past, highlighting the political and the economic changes that have created the present.
Today, we speak with Deb Cowan.
Hi, my name is Deborah Cowan. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Geography at the University of Toronto. The title of my book is The Deadly Life of Logistics, Mapping Violence in Global Trade. And the book really tries to take a look at the ways in which military calculation and specifically the history of logistics as a field of military calculation has really become so deeply entangled in the world of trade that we need to rethink both the logics and geographies of imperialism. The book starts with a kind of brief history of logistics, focusing on early modern warfare, but reaching back a little bit to much earlier times to think about the history of logistics. And then the main focus of the book, I would say, takes up contemporary sites and spaces and struggles where I think there is at least good evidence that some really significant kinds of transformation and experimentation is underway in terms of both security and political and legal space more broadly. It takes us from the Gulf of Aden and struggles over so-called Somali pirates to the west coast of North America and labor struggles over longshore work and trade circulation, and to places like Dubai, where I think important precedents are being set in terms of both the management of trade, labor, and security.
Let's start with this term logistics. What do you mean when you use this term? What kind of actors and processes are you writing about?
I guess I would start by saying that there are, of course, very popular notions of logistics. We refer to logistics, many of us refer to logistics all the time as the kind of residual or uncomplicated tasks, almost mindless materialities that require doing. So if you're organizing a birthday party and someone's got to deal with the logistics, that's sort of like almost like the grunt work. And I would say that that definition, that kind of popular definition of logistics is remains quite powerful in terms of its resonance and salience in popular discourse. Ironically, at the same time as logistics has become not only increasingly complex in terms of being one of the more absolutely complex techno-scientific kinds of practices and industries out there, but also in terms of its ascendance over the last century, really, almost century, in terms of being at the center of the management of both global trade and warfare. So we could move from a more popular definition, I guess, to thinking about an industry definition. And really, the industry definition of supply chain management or logistics management doesn't have such a long history. It's really just since the 1960s and 70s when we saw the birth of this new field of business management called logistics management, which is now increasingly called supply chain management. And in the industry understanding of logistics, it's really the central coordinating and managing discipline of an industry that the World Bank defines as the backbone of international trade. So it's taken very seriously in the world of business management. And is almost has a kind of imperial definition in those fields. So it ranges to include like all forms of production and distribution and information management in some industry kinds of definitions.
Could you tell us a little more about how you're thinking about logistics? It would be easy to think very functionally about the field. Logistics is, after all, about moving goods from point A to point B. But you suggest it's much more than that.
In terms of my engagement, I really try to think about logistics as a form of techne, as a form of the how of power. So both a kind of techno-scientific engagement with calculation and the organization of capitalism and war, but a specifically material engagement with those forms. So logistics to me is defined not just by questions of the how of power, but an incredibly material, even when it's informational flows, an incredibly material engagement with those problems.
Can you tell us a little bit about how the book developed, or was there a key piece of evidence that catalyzed the research process?
There was a moment where I felt like what I was seeing was so strange in the world of national security. And that moment for me came when, in the wake of 2001 and the kind of scramble of border security, national security, and trade security that followed, there was this declaration that came from many sites, especially the world of trade management, that national security had become a threat to national security. And of course, a claim like that is confusing to say the least, but it actually made some important sense that I felt really needed to be unpacked. The sense I started to make of that claim was really that traditional forms of territorial or border security were creating profound disruption and systemic disruption to global trade flows. And so we saw that this kind of outright conflict, or at least seeming outright conflict, between the question of tightening borders and the question of facilitating trade flows. But a whole new both industry and discipline started to emerge, a field called supply chain security, which is now recognized in academic institutions. It has textbooks. In really just a decade, this field called supply chain security has worked to recast how we understand and practice national security. The key being to this challenge of both facilitating flows and maintaining something like border security. And there's been a whole variety of efforts in that regard. And that's really the central context for the problems that the book takes up in the present.
Can you trace the history of how we got to the point where logistics is crucial to how capitalism operates? You write about the long history of logistics in the military, but the field wasn't always at the center of business.
There's a moment that is definitive in terms of where we are today, which takes place really in the post-World War II period, and has been named the revolution in logistics. And for me, when I started working on this research towards this book, I had almost hoped to see a civilianization of logistics, because my last major project and a lot of my prior work was on questions of warfare and militaries, and I was almost excited to move away from that just out of a kind of ethical political exhaustion. But what became clear to me was this event that is referred to as the revolution in logistics, which indeed and very much gave birth to the business management practice and field of logistics. So business logistics emerged out of this revolution. At the same time, it was in no way a civilianization of the field, but rather a kind of deepened entanglement between the worlds of war and trade, both institutionally, but also practically on the ground. So previous to the revolution in logistics, production took place in, or was understood to take place in, a site called the factory, and distribution was something that happened afterwards. And distribution, the whole question of transport and distribution, was understood as something not at the center of business strategy, not at the center of the model of accumulation, in the sense that value was understood to be produced in the production process, and the role of distribution was not important, not understood as crucial or critical to that key aim of the firm, but rather was understood as a way of at least cost trying to get that commodity to market. If you think about what I was already saying about the kind of popular notion of logistics as something residual and kind of unimportant, that definitely follows in the world of business management. And we also saw that echoed in the world of the military. What happens with the revolution in logistics is the world of business management starts to tell itself and to tell both the military and corporate world that we can actually make much better decisions, and better meaning more profitable decisions, if we think about accumulation and value as not something that happens in production and then we just try and kind of get that thing to market, but rather if we think about material management across production and distribution, what that suggests is that we can think about value added across that whole business system. So systems analysis and systems thinking become really important at this point.
What are the implications of the revolution in logistics? How does it matter for business, but also for workers?
The implications are actually maybe not obvious, but actually become really, really definitive. And one example I could give you, which comes from like a 1960s paper in business management, is really to suggest that if we take all these different factors of production and distribution seriously, and by that they're saying things like warehouse costs, transport costs, materials management in production, inventory costs, the whole gamut of costs and benefits that come across the business cycle, then we can make much more profitable decisions, for instance, by moving a warehouse much further away from the production site rather than closer to it, if that warehouse can actually provide certain kinds of functions and save money. The short of it being, if we bring all these costs together, like the field of total cost did, if we bring all these kinds of costs together, we might actually get a very, very different picture of the most profitable geographies for business management itself. And so the question of offshoring or outsourcing is obviously important in terms of understanding anything about capitalism of the last few decades. But it's not just about the labor costs of production. It's very, very much about a complicated total cost of production, distribution, warehousing, and other kinds of functions of business, the business kind of system or cycle. One of the things I would suggest is that transportation, what we might think of as transportation, trucking, shipping, various kinds of ways that we move goods, is actually a part of the production process and not something that happens afterwards. And this is in many ways not a new insight. It's something that Marx takes up very centrally in volume 2 of Capital. At the same time, it's not something that we're used to thinking about, that production is also transportation, that transportation brings value and is an active part of the production process. And the implications for this blurring of the factory and the distribution process are, I think, really profound in terms of both the logics of how and where things are made, but also in terms of what we even understand production to consist of. And the implications for this are that we start to see the importance of what has been very helpfully talked about in terms of just-in-time distribution or just-in-time production, where time and space become very, very crucially entangled, and the speed of circulation itself becomes absolutely critical for productivity cycles to kind of be effective for contemporary capitalism. But it also suggests that we can start to trace some very, very particular geographies to this contemporary architecture of capitalism. And those geographies are important both for understanding the world of labor. So we can think about crucial zones where disruption can be incredibly effective leverage. So whether that's ports on the west coast of the U.S. that handle so much of the world's trade heading from more production-centered spaces to more consumption-centered spaces, or whether it's thinking about indigenous uprisings and blockadings of rail or highway spaces in Canada or India or other parts of the world, whether it's thinking about anti-colonial uprisings in places like the Gulf of Aden, where so-called Somali pirates have been disrupting maritime traffic in large part in response to things like the toxic waste dumping and new forms of imperialism in East Africa. We can think about how these things land and are operating in very particular spaces, and how our everyday lives, in, of course, very, very different ways, depending on who we are and where we are, but nevertheless are entangled in this complicated global architecture.
Maybe you could tell us a little bit about some of these other innovations that allowed for this revolution in logistics, perhaps, you know, most notably the shipping container, but also flags of convenience and wooden pallets.
There's been, I'd say, a whole series of technologies that have been absolutely crucial in terms of making this revolution in logistics possible, and so also making our contemporary the contemporary forms of capitalism and warfare possible. And interestingly, and maybe not surprisingly, many of these technologies also have a kind of military genesis. So we could think about some of the most important being technologies like, of course, the shipping container, flags of convenience. And I would also want to highlight just the computer itself, because none of this could have ever happened without the computer and the capacity to calculate in vast quantities and in real time what is now an incredibly digitally organized enterprise. The shipping container is maybe the most obviously important, and certainly one that has very well deservingly gotten a lot of attention over recent years. So I'm thinking of Levin's book on the box as arguing that the single most important technology of globalization was the shipping container. And I absolutely agree with the emphasis and the importance on the shipping container. What the shipping container has allowed to happen is really for a kind of intermodal, as it's known, intermodal entanglement of the world of physical distribution or transportation or just simply mobility, the mobility of materialities, the movement of stuff. And this is the shipping container became so important because what it allowed shipping companies to do, it allowed them to radically reduce the amount of labor that went into moving stuff. So the shipping container, what defines it is that it's standardized. It's a standardized form that demanded that all the infrastructures of circulation, of physical goods circulation, also became standardized around this one form. So that literally the size and the dimensions of this box became a kind of metric for the infrastructures of global capitalism. And so what it allowed was, for those who aren't familiar with the basic kind of operation of the shipping container, it is a box that can be moved from the maritime world, so from ships, container ships, to truck chassis, to rail car, and back onto those other forms again and again. And it means that the labor of actually moving goods has become much more the labor of moving these containers rather than unpacking and repacking goods themselves. So I had the experience early in my research of going up one of these big gantry cranes with longshore workers in a port in just outside of Vancouver. And, you know, I was literally sitting in this very, very tall crane looking down through a glass floor at the movement of one container at a time off of a ship onto truck, onto the beds of trucks. And they were moving at a pace of about one container every 1 to 2 minutes. And this is not, this is by eye, by hand. This is not completely computerized like it would be in some ports like the Port of Singapore. And so just the kind of pace and speed of unloading those containers, in contrast to how the situation would have been before the container, where longshore workers with the kind of giant hooks would literally get on board ships and unload pallets and packages, has meant that there's just at that one space of global trade, the port, the maritime port, we've seen ship turnaround time go from several weeks before the container to a matter of a few days in the context of the container. And so you can extend that that model kind of to every space and site along supply chains and think about the ways in which that both reduces labor time, but also changes the nature of work that transport workers are doing.
You've highlighted very well how logistics has changed the geography of production and has also changed who does the work and how the work is done. And in the book, you make a larger point about how this transformation has reshaped how imperialism operates in the contemporary moment. Could you tell us a little bit more about that?
I think one of the ways in which the relationships between all of this discussion about logistics, to me, maps onto and helps us actually diagnose contemporary imperialism, it became most apparent to me really in thinking about the space of the supply chain. In a sense, we can think about the supply chain itself this kind of as a kind of linear form that follows the infrastructures of transportation. And so maybe in a sense, the kind of paradigmatic space of the supply chain would be like the rail line or the shipping line, these kinds of lines that traverse both maritime and territorial space that serve as the kinds of pipelines of flow, as many business managers talk about it. So literally using the metaphor of a pipeline to think about the space of cargo circulation was to me really suggestive in the sense that we could think back to the kinds of geographies of imperial circulation and settlement that took form in the kind of and settler colonial context. The image that I offer up in the book of the kind of line of the kind of contemporary supply chain in contrast to the kind of, you know, the line of the stagecoach or the kind of movement westward that was also not accidentally threatened by anti-colonial and anti-imperial forces like indigenous uprisings or piracy, episodes of piracy. So I was thinking very much about this space of contemporary imperialism, and this made me also kind of shift some of my argument very centrally in the book to think not so much that all of this is new, not that the whole question of the shape of the geographies and logics of contemporary imperialism are brand new, but actually that they have incredible resonance with a kind of earlier form of imperialism that makes the nation state, the kind of territorial nation state, a bit of the oddball here rather than the norm that we're somehow deviating from. And so I kind of offer that up because to me, the questions of space, geography, and materiality really do help us think about the challenging political stakes of logistics space.
How do you think your work relates to the activism people are currently engaged in around questions of globalization and imperialism?
It was wonderfully surprising to me that the reception of the book has been as broad as it has, and especially given that I spent so much of my time in these obscure archives of, you know, business management history, like, you know, kinds of inquiry that were certainly obscure, if not kind of pathetically nerdy, and seemingly very academic. The reception of the book has been really exciting to me, because it's been certainly, like, there's academics taking it up and looking to it and thinking it through and engaging it. But I think I'm delighted that a whole range of different activist groups, especially labor, indigenous activists, and various kinds of groups that have been involved in port disruptions and occupations have been finding it helpful, which was, I mean, definitely my intention, but not necessarily something I expected to be visible in the form that the book took, especially on a topic that has a kind of, seemingly banal focus. And I would say, first and foremost, my contemporary intervention, which relies on some kinds of histories of capitalism, was to try and get some scholars and activists to move away from thinking purely about either the militarization of trade or the corporatization of war, both of which are profoundly important kind of empirical shifts that we could trace in our present. We've seen the rise of private military companies, of mercenaries, and all of the complicated political, legal, and kind of forms of violence that come with that. So without a doubt, we're seeing the privatization of military force. We are also, of course, seeing the militarization of trade. And we can point to all kinds of forms of industrial security, the entanglement of state security and extractive resources, the creation, for instance, in the Canadian context, of state security agents, units in our federal agencies specifically devoted to tracking and surveilling, for instance, Indigenous activists that are blockading pipeline projects or other kinds of extractive industries. So there's no question that we've seen the securitization of trade, and maybe in deepening ways over recent years. But to me, what I was seeing in the world of logistics was something much more profound about the entanglements of war and trade, not at the level of just a kind of contemporary empirical deepening or shift, but really that had to take us back to questions of imperialism.
So in closing, I want to ask you a question about an idea that you close the book with. And the idea is that logistics is more than just a business strategy or a business discourse, but it actually affects how we think about life and death itself. Can you tell us a little bit more about that claim?
It really starts with the argument that logistics as an imperial management science is concerned centrally with not just the movement of cargo, but something much more crucial and something much more profound if we take seriously the military dimensions of logistics as not just something of the past, but also something very much ongoing. So logistics to me is really important to think about as an imperial management science concerned with provisioning life itself. And by life itself, I don't mean something abstract. I'll give you a couple of examples. One of the kind of objects that I became very interested in very early on in this work, after spending time with military logisticians, was the kinds of food that militaries provide their personnel, both in the present but also historically. So the ways in which the military has understood and organized food provision has very important implications for military personnel, but is also had profound implications for food much more globally. So we can think about pretty much like all forms of food preservation, whether it's canning or drying, the packaging of food, the preservation of food itself all comes out of war efforts. And the war effort being crucial because it allowed for the harnessing of both state and industrial power to solve technological problems with a lot of resources, those technological problems being all about sustaining the life of soldiers, but obviously in the context of soldiers who are going to be taking the lives of others, or at least with that aim. And so that was one instance where the history of military logistics and right into the present suggested to me that logistics is not just about sustaining life, but it's sustaining life and producing death. Another instance I could just cite, because it was really clarifying for me in terms of some of the very grounded ways in which logistics is very much about life and death, and not just about these kinds of banal facts of moving goods around, came when I happened upon a kind of exhibition of global trade that was happening in the Port of Vancouver during one of my research trips there. And one of the stalls at this exhibition was for agricultural genetics, and the booth was all organized around images and promotion of pig genetics. And the argument that the company was making was that they were able to actually engineer life forms, in this case swine, pigs, to fit the production process of slaughtering and packaging the pigs. So the pigs themselves had standardized hip and width forms so that they would fit seamlessly into this production process, which is, of course, a process of slaughter. And so I started to think about some of the very powerful ways in which logistics as a kind of way of managing and calculating and organizing the arrangement of life is also always tied to the production of death. In a sense, the queer theory question, which might not look like queer theory to many people who assume it's, you know, primarily dealing with sexual practices or identities, became more a question of what kind of lives matter and whose lives matter, and the complicated ways that a kind of biopolitics of race and nation and reproduction are inherent to the practice of contemporary imperialism that is organized largely through something like logistics. But if logistics is the field that's really concerned with organizing the material, the materiality of the how of contemporary capitalism and the how of contemporary imperialism, which is also very much concerned with making some populations prosper at the expense of others, then queer theory, as infused by kind of critical race and anti-colonial theory, really helped me to think about, or I feel helped me to think about, what does it mean to ask differently, to push differently and to prioritize differently around life itself in the context of the politics of contemporary imperialism?
If you liked our show, make sure to check us out at whomakessensepodcast.com. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/whomakessense, and follow us on Twitter at whomakessense. And let us know if there are topics that you want to know more about.
You can also learn more about Deb's work at our website, whomakessensepodcast.com.
Who Makes Sense is supported by the Yale Public Humanities Program and the University of Southern California's Department of American Studies and Ethnicity.
Join us next month for more Histories of Capitalism.